Thank you. What is your response to charges that the, quote, early publication of these scrolls would lead to misinterpretation by unskilled scholars? In fact, you mentioned in one of your articles that supermarket tabloids were among the avenues that were being used to determine what was being said in the scrolls.
Well, I think that there's a lot of irresponsible scholarship going on. And I think that pseudo-scholarship, if you will. And it's very difficult for the public to assess some of this scholarship. I mean, if you have someone who says this who has an academic position, how do you know whether he's or she has a valid point or not? It's often hard to judge. And that is a problem. And some of my opponents said that that's what would happen if we freed the scrolls. Some of the scholarship goes all the, some of the, it's not scholarship. We have tabloids that tell you that Elvis is found, and references to Elvis are found in the scrolls, that predictions for 1993 are in the scrolls, and silliness like this. On the other hand, you have a consensus on major points. And yet within the scholarly community, you have what I call one-person theories. So while I have opposed the official editing team because of their unwillingness to give other scholars access, in general, I support their interpretations of the text. I think that they are right. I think they do themselves harm when they make it appear that they're forcing their interpretations on us by not allowing others to express their views. We live in a democracy where there's a clash of ideas, and I have confidence and faith, if you will, that the truth will out, and there is some foolishness going on. But I think, in the end, bad scholarship will fall of its own weight. And if that's the price we pay for freedom, and not only in this area, it's a price well worth paying.
On to the subject of the Israeli court ruling. You have the recent Israeli court ruling against you. Could you explain it a little bit for American audience, and what is the impact of that ruling on archaeological study?
The court ruling is wrong, I believe. I think it presents an obstacle to sound scholarship. In our book of photographs, we reproduced the Hebrew text of a very important letter known as MMT. We photocopied it from a Polish journal that had published it. Copies of it were circulating all over the world. Almost all scholars in the field had it, studied it, gave classes in it. Yet the text officially is still unavailable. Even today, it's unavailable. You can't see it. But there was an Achilles heel in our publication. The letter existed in six fragmentary copies, and this Israeli scholar made a composite from the six, and he went beyond that, and where words and letters and sometimes a series of words had not survived, he inserted them in brackets to show that this was his reconstruction of what the original author had said. The suit was over copyright, and the court held that these reconstructions belonged to him, were his authorship for copyright purposes, and that therefore we had violated it. There are obviously overtones in the suit. I think that this is the price that we're paying for having taken an unpopular position in some quarters. I think it presents an obstacle to scholarship because, according to scholarly convention, once he publishes it, then other scholars can use it. But according to copyright law, since he owns the copyright in it, even after publication, you won't be able to use it without his permission. And that means that a scholar who studies it and finds that he agrees with this reconstruction, he can't copy that without the threat of a lawsuit. It has a terrible chilling effect. The same scholar has already written to two American scholars, one at Hebrew Union College and another at a seminary in Illinois, that if they, quote, make any use of his reconstruction, he will sue them. And as a result, they said, I don't want to take that chance. We can't afford to do that, to defend a lawsuit. So this is the downside of that decision from a precedential point of view. What we're going to do, it's very expensive to fight a lawsuit in Israel. I just got a bill this morning for translating the judge's decision, $1,000 just to translate the decision. So it's that kind of financial hemorrhage that we don't know what we're going to do. The scholarly community may have to face it themselves. And try to work within this and make its own conventions as to what its members can do. We may appeal, I don't know. That's up in the air at this time. But that is the result at this point.
Back on to the scrolls. In your opinion, why were the original seven Dead Sea Scrolls so well preserved? Why were they able to survive nearly intact for almost 2,000 years? And also, why were they hidden in the first place?
Well, why they survived, there's a couple of answers to that. No one imagined that texts like this could survive, but the fact is that they survived because it's very dry there, and it's in a dark atmosphere, so that the environment was right. Why these seven survived was because intact was because that they were in the jars. The others were not in jars, and even the ones that have survived are sometimes worm eaten and deteriorated. The mother lode that I talked about in Cave 4. We don't really know why they got there. What are 500 scrolls doing in a cave? And there are all kinds of theories. One is that they were brought here from Jerusalem. It's really a Jerusalem library. And when the Romans were threatening to destroy Jerusalem, and it didn't take a very smart guy to realize what was coming on, that they took the scrolls out into the desert and hid them. There are also theories that in this mother lode, Cave 4, Roman soldiers may have gotten in and tramped around there and destroyed them, because there are a lot of ancient tears and rips. And this is one explanation to account for that. It may have been, some others say it was a geniza. A geniza is a place for worn out sacred documents, so that they were put there for this reason. But it's all speculation. That's about as much as we know.
Could you comment on the thesis of Kemal Saliba, the Arab author of The Bible Came from Arabia, that many of the sites of the Old Testament events should be located in the Arabian Peninsula rather than in Sinai and Israel?
I can't say that I'm intimately familiar with that, but it's not a completely unreasonable theory. The reasons that he gives are linguistic, and I don't think they hold up. And here I'm relying on the views of a great Harvard scholar, Frank Cross. I interviewed Frank Cross recently, and I myself was curious about this, and the way I put it, and I understand that we have a representative of the Saudi press here today, the Saudi Gazette, so he'll find this of particular interest. I asked Frank Cross if the Exodus went through Saudi Arabia. And he found that a very provocative way of putting it. He didn't really like to respond in that terms. But if I called the area Midian, then he said yes. So the fact is that according to very eminent biblical authority, just south of Aqaba, in the Arabian Peninsula, are a lot of the sites that are mentioned and are part of the trek of the Israelites northward to the land of promise. So there is something to that.
Back on the subject of deciphering the scrolls and what you have, how has the development of computer technology affected the processing of fragmentary scraps?
Well, computer technology has advanced, and one of the good things about bringing this out into the open and getting people interested is finally, instead of just sitting there doing very little if anything, that now scholars are looking at all these possibilities. And there are several ways that computers are helping. One is simply from inventory. I mean, you have thousands of documents. Another way is that there is computer enhancement of some of the words and the letters. You may have heard of a famous document now called the Pierced Messiah fragment. And obviously, this is very significant for students of early Christianity. Is there a reference to a pierced, or that is crucified, Messiah at Qumran? Two scholars suggested that they have found a fragment that indeed makes this reference. Other scholars say that they have misread a word. You know, in Hebrew is written without vowels. It's consonantal. So you can get two different meanings depending on what vowels you put into these consonants. And if you do it one way, you come out that the Messiah did the piercing or killing. And if you do it another way, you come out with the Messiah was pierced or was killed. So it makes a big difference. Most scholars today contend that in this fragment, it was the Messiah who was doing the killing or piercing, not the reverse. Part of this demonstration that it was in fact the Messiah who was doing the killing results from computer enhancement of the fragment. It's a five-line fragment, but if you enhance it, you can see the top of a sixth line. And if you reconstruct that, you can get a context which helps you supply the vowels, which tells you it was the Messiah who was doing the killing and not was being killed. Beyond that, they haven't done it yet, but they're going to put the fragments on CD-ROM. And with that capacity, they will be able to take these fragments and move them around and find fits and joins with the help of the computer. So I would say that the computer has great potential. It's only beginning to be realized.
Thank you. Back on the subject of possible bombshells, with the publishing of the facsimile volumes, can we expect any bombshells in biblical or historical interpretation of the period that would affect the way most people understand Judaism or Christianity?
I don't think that there are going to be any bombshells. I think that already the fragments have been combed. First of all, I don't know what would be considered a bombshell. I suppose if you found a marriage certificate of Joseph and Mary of Nazareth, what would it say that's going to undermine faith? This is not the nature of that kind of the kind of documents we're dealing with. What I think it's going to do is deepen our understanding of a historical period. And I think that, one of the questions I ask myself is why is the public so fascinated with the Dead Sea Scrolls? Is it because they are expecting bombshells, or is it because that they somehow sense that this is going to deepen our understanding of our Judeo-Christian heritage, of our own roots and how it developed, and enrich our understanding of our religions? It's a kind of faith with me that I think that this, even the person in the street realizes that it'll be some time and it'll be a struggle, but it's going to affect the way we think about our past in subtle ways. In terms of bombshells, I don't think so. Now, it depends on what you mean by a bombshell, too. To scholars, we'll take the Pierced Messiah. Suppose it said that there was a Messiah who was pierced. Is that a bombshell? I don't think that Jesus of Nazareth is going to remain unique. I don't think that there need be any concern about that. So really what this gives us is background. We have, for example, a Son of God a century before Christianity. Now, to the person who accepts the New Testament as inerrant, as literally true, does this affect that person? I think it makes him or her a little queasy at first, but you soon say, well, this is the way God prepared it. If you accept a literal understanding of the New Testament, this is all part of God's preparation. If you look for a less divine incursion into history and look at the evolution and development of a religion in historical terms, then you begin to understand how the concepts of Christianity developed. Take, for example, this very concept of the Son of God. In one sense, you say this is a bombshell. I thought Son of God was unique in the Christian religion. Jesus was the Son of God. But when you begin to study it, you find a whole development of this concept. I mean, the Egyptian pharaohs were sons of God. The Roman emperors were sons of God. But if you look more closely at the Jewish tradition, at the Bible, did you know that the kings of Israel were sons of God? Read Psalm 2, which says that the king is my only begotten son. What the Mashiach in Hebrew, or Messiah, means is simply the anointed one. When the king was anointed with some oil, some olive oil, he became the Son of God. And after the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem, the temple was destroyed. It ended a 400-year Davidic reign. The Messiah came to be the hope for the restoration of that very earthly kingdom. As time passed, and it didn't come about, then this idea of Messiah changed a little bit, and it was a kind of end of days, apocalyptic return of still a political kingdom. But you see a development there. And finally, in the New Testament, you have a genealogy and an impregnation of a virgin, and the child becomes at that point the Son of God. Well, this is a whole development, and if you would look at what the Dead Sea Scroll text says 100 years before this, you would see that it fits precisely into that development just where you would expect it. So that in this sense it's very exciting, but it's not a bombshell. The same thing we could analyze the Beatitudes, which have recently been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are Beatitudes in the Hebrew Bible, if you look. This surprises people. And as a matter of fact, there are two sets of Beatitudes in the New Testament. I sometimes ask my audiences, how many of you have heard of the Sermon on the Mount? And practically everybody raises their hand. Let me ask you folks, how many of you have heard of the Sermon on the Plain? I see one person in a Roman collar, and a couple of other people have heard of the Sermon on the Plain. Well, there is a Sermon on the Plain. It's in the New Testament, and it differs from the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. And you see various kinds of developments in the concept of the Beatitudes and what they say. And if you look at the Beatitudes in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will find they fit right in that series. So what the Dead Sea Scrolls are creating is not bombshells, but background, enlightenment, enrichment of where these concepts and ideas came from and how they developed and through what process and in what cultural milieu.
Is it true that a chapter of Isaiah was found in the scrolls that had been excluded from the Hebrew Bible? If it is true, do you know what the significance is of this chapter?
The answer is no. There was no chapter of Isaiah excluded from the Hebrew Bible. There was a paragraph on Samuel that was dropped from the Hebrew Bible, which explains the motivation for someone gouging some eyes out. In general, though, Isaiah was very important to the sect, whether it's Essenes or Sadducees or whatever. To be safe, we talk about the sect, the Qumran sect. Isaiah was a very important book, and it was found in many copies, I think something like 20 copies. And of course it was obviously very important for early Christianity as well. And there is in one of the copies of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is a mark under the column at chapter 40. And chapter 40, verse 3, you may recall, in the Hebrew Bible, reads like this: "A voice cries out, 'In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God.'" And there's a special check in the Dead Sea Scroll copy of this. And of course, Mark quotes this, and he says in Mark, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord." So the fact that you have so many copies of Isaiah and a little special mark at this kind of illustrates the importance of this same apocalyptic passages that were so important in early Christianity and in the Qumran sect. And it may well be that John the Baptist actually lived at Qumran. Incidentally, if I can, parenthetical thought on that, there is no reference to Jesus in the scrolls, clear. one far-out scholar, and this is an example of some of the wilder theories, the one-man theories or one-person theories. One scholar, a Spanish Jesuit by the name of O'Callaghan, yep, that's not a mistake, has analyzed the few Greek fragments. 75% of the fragments are in Hebrew, 25% in Aramaic. But there are a few, in one of the caves, a few Greek fragments. And he has found a fragment which contains 20 letters, but only half of them are complete. So half of them are partial letters, and it's sometimes hard to tell what those letters are. And there's only one full word, chi, which means and. And O'Callaghan says that this is a fragment from the Gospel of Mark. And that's his evidence. That's pretty far out, and yet when mainline scholars talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they have to address theories of like this, or of a Australian scholar who claims that Jesus was raised near Qumran and was crucified at Qumran and didn't die, but went on to get married and have more children. Actually, he was married before he was crucified to Mary Magdalene, according to this author, and then later divorced her and went to move to Rome, where he died in seclusion. And if you believe this, I have a bridge I want to sell you. But this is the kind of theories which are very far out and get more attention, really, than they deserve.
Before we close out, Mr. Shanks, I'd like to present to you a certificate of appreciation signed by President of the Press Club, Clayton Boyce. And we found this in one of the dusty caves of the Press Club. It's a coffee mug. And I hope that you enjoy it. The last question is from someone who calls himself Indiana Jones. Do you have any work ahead of you regarding the Ark of the Covenant?
I don't think the Ark of the Covenant will be found. I don't think it exists. But there are... Do I have 2 minutes?
Sure, go ahead.
There are some exciting mysteries that still abound. I'll mention two very briefly. One is the Copper Scroll, and that's important to Wendell Jones, who's looking for the ashes of the red heifer. But the Copper Scroll, I mentioned that these scrolls are mainly on leather, not parchment, but they're not tan, but leather, pre-parchment, and about 25% of them are papyrus. But one of them is on copper, and it contains nothing but a list of 64 locations, like a laundry list, of buried treasure and huge amounts of gold and silver. Is it real? Is it fictional? It doesn't have a story with it. If it had a story with it, you would think it's a part of a story, not true. But this is just very like it was written by an accountant. And it's in this area. And you can't find them today, but you know it's in this area. But it says go to Chaim's house, and around the back of the stairs is a tree, and walk 40 paces from there and dig, and you'll find several tons of gold. It's that kind of thing. And most scholars think that this is real. And what was it? Was it the temple treasure that was taken here and hidden before the Romans reached it? That's one theory. There are others. So the idea of the Ark of Covenant, finding that is, I don't believe it. But the idea that there are still mysteries, still things that we're going to find, the Dead Sea Scrolls stories have everything. And another mystery is whether there are more scrolls. And with that, I'll close. There are two possibilities. One is that there are still caves there, and these caves are in the Great Rift Valley, where there are lots of earthquakes periodically, and as a result, many of these caves have their ceilings collapsed with huge boulders on the floor. And if we remove those boulders, we may find other scrolls. As a matter of fact, in the early 50s, a kibbutznik tells this story, but he was with some archaeologists, with some Israeli archaeologists in nearby caves, and they were working in a cave where they found an enormous amount, but there was one of these roof collapses. And in the center was this huge pile of boulders that nobody could remove. And he wriggled down into it when he was slim and young with a flashlight in his hand. And as he looked on the floor, he saw a skeleton wrapped in a white robe with a rope belt around the waist, just as the Essenes are described in the ancient literature. And he reached down and he pulled the robe out, which had disintegrated underneath because the bodily fluids had deteriorated and disintegrated the robe. And that's all we have. But the question remains, are there scrolls under that pile of rocks in that cave, or in the hundreds of other caves? And one final question, are there scrolls out there that somebody's still holding that hasn't surfaced? The longest of the scrolls didn't surface until after the 67 war, the Temple Scroll. Are there others? John Strugnell, who used to be the chief editor and was fired after making some anti-Semitic remarks, claims that there are. He was having emotional problems at the time, but as I say, the Dead Sea Scrolls has everything. It even has a little pornography, which I'll close with. John Strugnell claims that one evening when he was living at the École Biblique at the Couvent, the French Dominican school in Jerusalem, two women came to see him, prostitutes, one Arab and one Jewish. They took him to a field in Bethlehem, and they removed from their private parts microfilms of two scrolls that still haven't surfaced. Maybe someday they will. Thank you.